Mr. Ferntree will tell.
And on the train, the other thing which comes to mind now is great big moths coming in through the windows and buzzing around the lights in the train. And all of us in a panic. I mean, we didn't know what they were. Great big huge moths as big as whatever, big as sparrows. And of course, flitting her in for the lights and stuff. And all the boys trying to catch them and trying to whoosh them out the way. And then we arrived in the morning sometime at Nairobi station. And we, of course, being the Irish Inniskilling Fusiliers, we had our own, we had our pipes and drums with our own pipe and drum band, because it was the whole, and we marched from the station with the pipes and drum band to a camp. It was called the Polo. It was the Polo Grounds in Nairobi, we were there for a couple of 3 weeks acclimatization until they sorted us out. I think they called it acclimatization, and that was at the Polo Grounds, Nairobi. And then from there, we then went to, I think, if I remember, it wasn't just us, there were lots on the troop ship. There were Rifle Corps, Green Jackets, I think, two or three different lots of regiments on the troop ship, and also who had come on to, all of us had come on to the Polo Grounds. And then the Irish Fusiliers, we went up to Naivasha, which is in the Rift Valley, they'd started to prepare a camp, because the battalion...
Is it the 1st Battalion?
The 1st Battalion was in Korea. And we were, I suppose, really, we were an advanced party. And we then went to this camp, this place in Naivasha, and started to get the camp ready. But I was also, at that time, then we were just us. There weren't many of us, I mean, I can't remember how many, but there weren't many. And we were attached to the police, the Kenya police, going out doing general patrols and stuff like that. So this was some time before the actual battalion arrived in Kenya. I'd already done some patrol work and stuff like that with the police in the forest areas. Then the battalion came, and our general duties were going out into the forest areas on patrol, and doing ambushes. And there were a couple of big operations that they organised, where the police, a couple of different regiments were involved with the operations in the Aberdare region, the forests. And which mainly consisted of sweeps, patrol work generally, tracking down terrorists. Then I was attached to the police more or less permanently, and
as an individual,
two or three of us, just as a small group. I think I remember our company moved up to the around the area of Meru, which is up in near the forest area, nearer the forest area, and we worked continually from there. We used to go out on patrol for perhaps 4 or 5 days at a time, perhaps three of us, with a tracker, and perhaps a police officer. And then we would work a particular area, looking for terrorists. If we had information that terrorists were in that area, then we would go in and do our best to track them down. Invariably, we were called to a farm where one of the outlying farms where that had been raided. The main practice was they'd invariably raid a farm to steal cattle for food, or sheep, or more cattle, mainly cattle, and for food. And then if they were disturbed, then invariably they would attack the farmer, the European farmer and his family. So I've seen one or two grim things where that has happened, and it has taken a couple of days for the news to come through, because it was usually somebody who originally worked on the farm, one of the farm boys, one of the people that worked on the farm for the Europeans, and they would come in and we would know that the farm had been attacked.
What exactly did you see? The remains of the farmer?
Yeah. On one particular occasion, we went to a farm, and the young husband had obviously opened the door in the dark. He'd opened the door at night with the light still on, and they'd shot him, and they'd killed his wife, young wife, and children, two children. They invariably didn't have proper weapons. They had homemade. They'd have a homemade rifle, which consisted of an electrical conduit, just an electric bit of pipe, fixed to a crude wooden butt, which they had carved themselves, with a door bolt, just a standard common or garden door bolt, and perhaps with a heavy piece of elastic band round it. And they would get hold of some ammunition, rounds of ammunition, and they crudely could fire that. They put the bullet in the end, and pull the door bolt back so that it sort of fired the bullet. But of course those bullets, there was no rifling in the thing, and they'd just twist and fly at all angles. So if they did find the target and hit anybody, they did terrible damage. Awful. I remember that vividly. That was one of the reasons that they were very, very strict with anybody who lost rounds of ammunition or left ammunition lying around, for that reason, that obviously it got into the wrong hands.
Did any of your comrades do that?
There was always somebody in the battalion or something who'd slip up, and they were in trouble for perhaps losing rounds of ammunition. They'd have periodic checks. You were issued with ammunition, which you kept all the time, and that was yours to keep and account for, obviously. But as with everything, there were always spares. There was always somebody who had a box with, you know, a few dozen rounds of ammunition. So you there was never much fear of being short. It's like everything. I mean, in the army, there's always somebody. You've always got. But they were very strict, and we were all conscious of that. That you know, we had to look after the ammunition and our weapons, which we had with us all the time, to look after them. That was something which was drummed into us time and time again, and safety, of course, with your weapons. But
were these bodies that you found just still lying there? Hadn't anybody cleared
them? No, they were just the chap. I remember he was still in the doorway, and the lady. The others were inside. The blacks themselves, the general workers on the farms, and that they were so afraid, which you could understand, of the Mau Mau, and invariably, so we were told, which we knew, a good percentage of them were Mau Mau themselves, because they had to be. One of the ways the Mau Mau recruited people was coercion. They would threaten you if they knew with your sisters or your mother, and if you didn't do such and such a thing, then they would kill your family, or they would do damage to your family. So most of these blacks who worked on the farms were involved in some minor way, and that's how the Mau Mau worked. They initially they would get you to do minor things like muck up. Perhaps if a woman or girl was a housekeeper or a house cleaner, work or cook, they'd get them to do minor things, break perhaps electrical things, or they'd get one of the boys perhaps to put sugar in the petrol tank of the car. All minor things, anything. But it gradually, one thing led to another. It got worse, and in the end, you were sort of doing real serious things. And of course, murder in the end. But the murder was, they had the hardcore, which were in the forest all the time, and they really were. They were the real terrorists, obviously, and we called that. They were the hardcore, and they were the ones that which we used to be looking for. We had on ambushes. I mean, we used to get regularly on ambush. We would. Perhaps get information. Women, you know, women are wicked, or could be wicked all the world over. So you would get a woman who perhaps has found out her husband's got other wives or carrying on with other women, and she would invariably come in and shop him, you know, say where he could be found or where he would be. Because at night, that was the only time really they could come out. Or to get the food, or get a food carrier, somebody going in to meet them to drop food off for them, and that is where invariably we would lay an ambush, wait for them, and of course all these areas they were prohibited areas, and there was a curfew on, so. There were no questions asked. I mean, if there was somebody there at that time, they could be shot.
Did you ever have any contacts whilst you were in ambushes or out on patrol with the Mau Mau?
Oh, yeah. On a couple of occasions. On one occasion, we were in the sort of Meru area on an ambush by a railway track. And we heard the noise, we heard talking, and we opened fire. And in the morning, when it got light, we went there, and there were three Mau Mau dead.
What did they look like?
They were black and pretty well shot up. Do you mean they were badly injured? Bad wounds.
So they were still alive?
No, they were dead. They were dead. And we were able, because of the location of the place, we were able to call the police. The police came with a jeep or truck and took the bodies away.
Did they have uniforms on?
No, they were just literally in rags. They invariably were. When we picked any of these up, or any of them were shot, nearly in all cases they were in rags. One of the things they used to have, part of their sort of standard uniform seemed to be, was Wellington boots. But they'd cut the feet off the boot, the Wellington, and just wear the long piece up their leg. I think that was probably perhaps partly for protection if they were running through the bush. You get lots of thorn bushes in Kenya, there's a thorn, you know, thorn bush and various bibs and bobs. But it seemed to be a bit of a uniform that if they were able to lay their hands on some old Wellington boots, they would do that, cut the feet off and just wear the boots as leggings. And another thing they would have, usually, would be perhaps half a dozen watches on their wrists. None of them worked. Perhaps some of them would not even have any works in them at all, but perhaps just for decoration. Perhaps it's just something that simple sort of, I wouldn't say simple-minded people, but they would have these watches on their wrists. Often we would find a body or bring them in, and they would have two or three watches on their wrists, just watch straps. But they were all poorly dressed. Sometimes a trilby hat, but they were all in tatters usually.
Was their hairstyle special?
Invariably, their hair was long. I remember on one occasion, now you've said that we come across a bloke in the forest, and he was quite frightening. He had long hair, plaited. It's a common sight now with these Rastafarians. But in those days, I didn't know what a Rastafarian, never seen a Rastafarian, I didn't know what a Rastafarian was. But similar to the Rastafarian, long, plaited, matted hair, plaits and beards, their beards plaited. And this particular fella, we come across him wandering about, but he had gone off his head. He definitely had gone off his head. He was mentally retarded, and he had long hair, and his beard was plaited, and we found him, sort of come across him wandering about, and we assumed he had been a Mau Mau, and perhaps been in the forest for so long, through neglect, he had gone a bit doolally.
What did you do with
him? We handed him over to the police.
Did he resist?
No, I don't think. He wasn't really too aware of what was happening. He was too far. He was definitely. He was mentally retarded.
Was this in the Aberdare area?
Yeah, it was in the Aberdare region. Because it was about that time, there was quite a large operation was about to go on in the Aberdare region, and we were up there for, I think I was there for 6 or 7 weeks, and I remember it sort of rained most of the time, so I remember being wet all the time. And we used mules, we had mules to carry our food and various bibs and bobs, and when that finished, my job, I was given the task of bringing the mules back down. There were four mules I had to bring down, and I hated animals. I was frightened of horses or mules or whatever, but I was put in charge of these to bring these back down, and I remember that journey quite vividly, bringing them down out from the Aberdare region, and they'd worked out the route for us so that we could stop at a farm or a couple of farms on the way in the evening. And I remember we stayed at one farm. One of these mules was a bit frisky, and as soon as you tried to put the panniers and things on its back, it kicked up a fuss. In fact, it kicked and jumped about and everything come off of it. And so you can imagine, we were really frightened of that one. But once we calmed it down and got everything strapped down, it was okay. But it was just that initial trying to get the things on its back. I can see that now, jumping up and kicking its legs, and all the things, all the panniers and things flying off of it. And I remember we stayed one night at the farm, and the following morning they were foreign. There was lots and lots of foreigners there had the farms, Italians. I believe, so we were told, that a lot of the Italian prisoners of war, we sent Italian prisoners of war to Kenya, and after the war, lots of them stayed on, probably did very nicely. And I know that lots of the farms were owned by Italians. This particular farm, I think this chap was a Scandinavian. I seem to remember, I think he was Norwegian or something. And it was quite a large farm, and we'd stayed there for the night. We didn't have anything off them. We had our own food. There were four of us and a black askari with us. And I remember he was a preacher, the black soldier. He was a part-time preacher, but he was a preacher, very religious. And so there was four of us and this black askari, and we did our own cooking, so we were self-sufficient. We never got anything off these people. And then in the morning, I used to, had to go across to them to tell them that we were leaving. And this particular time, I went across to this farmer to tell him that we were off, we were going, and the two dogs came after me, bull terriers, and got me around the ankles and pulled me over. And we had, we wore high-legged boots in Kenya. And, I mean, if it hadn't been for these high-legged boots, they'd have really torn me to pieces. Because one got me around the ankle, and one got me sort of in the calf. But these boots saved me quite a lot. And the farmer came out and sort of pulled them off of me. But I remember that. That wasn't a very nice experience. On another occasion, I remember we got a call from, this was in Naivasha, a farm, which was, I think it was called Anderson's Farm, and it was a place called Anderson, near Anderson's Gorge. And they had been raided. I think they had sheep taken. And we got up there as quickly as we could, and the farmer, who presumably was a Mr. Anderson, he had shot one of these raiders, the Mau Mau raiders, and the bullet had gone through his throat, and he was propped up by an outhouse, still alive, but I mean, to all intents and purposes, he was just alive, but the bullet had gone through, clean through his throat. And he was, his eyes were wide open, and he was foaming at the mouth, sort of, in an awful state. And I remember feeling that, you couldn't help him, felt helpless because there was nothing we could do. He was all but dead. And one of the farm boys told us in which direction these raiders had gone. There were three of them still had run off, and we went after them, and we found a couple of sheep dead. They hadn't had time to cut them up, and just across there was a bit of a ravine or a gully. We suddenly saw one of these chaps stood up, and he waved at us to try to probably make us think that he was a farm worker. I remember that he waved across to us, and we shot him. This man.
How did you know he wasn't a farm worker?
Well, we didn't. But it was somebody who shouldn't have been there at that time. I mean, we were sure he was a Mau Mau. We knew they were in the area, these three fellas, and the farm workers were on the farm. It was it wasn't grazing land or anything. It was by a gully. It was by this gorge, this place called Anderson's Gorge. And as I say, this chap, we just knew that he was a Mau. We just knew he was a terrorist. And we fired him, we shot him. When we went across there, one of the bullets had hit him in the head and smashed his head. And the others, there was no trace of the others. We looked for hours for to see if the others were in the area. They may well have been there hiding, but I remember I went back to the farm, and off the lady asked her if she had any cloth or anything, and she gave me a tea. I think she gave me a tablecloth. And I then went back to where this chap was, folded up the tablecloth, and I laid it by the side of him and wrapped his head up in the tablecloth and pinned it, just to sort of keep it in one piece, as it were. And we brought that body in to the farm. We called up the police again, I think, and the police took those bodies away. The one that had died by then, plus this other fella. When I first went to Kenya, we used to have to take, where possible, take fingerprints. Anybody that we killed, any terrorist, take a fingerprint or cut the hand off, the hand. And I've never done that, but I've been I don't think I could do it. But when on the early patrols, we had trackers with us, or a guide. And they were usually Maasai, quite nice fellas, who knew the area, knew the place, the area intimately, and they would do that. And the Church of Scotland, I'm sure it was the Church of Scotland who had quite a big influence in Kenya, they kicked up a fuss and they said how barbaric it was for us to cut hands off of these people, and how could we teach them that it's wrong to